Welcome to the Church of Mabus. It's Saturday night, and we got Jack Nicholson in here tonight, ready to be interviewed about Beaver and UFOs. So that's what we're going to do, Nicholson. It's Saturday night, and it's time to bang a little bit of Beaver, because that's what we do on Saturday nights. All right.
My favorite subject.
Beaver and UFOs. What's up with that chat room? I go in there for a few weeks. I hang out. Everything's cool. I go in there tonight, and then the grandma patrols on me. I'm blocked out again. Those chicks, man, they hit EMS in there, and they're like piranhas. I thought we were cool now. I go to hang out. It's like, oh, no, 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 no.
You're annoying.
Then we got to wait till March, and that broad's gone, and her whole Puss 2 patrol. All those chicks are out of there in March. They won't be amends anymore if she leaves in March, right? They lose their powers.
I don't know. They may just give a new room or something.
Yeah, that's the PMS room. So, I don't care what they do. I just wanted to spam the room anyway. I even tried to sneak in there under a different name and spam the room, and it wouldn't let me. For some reason, it said that name was blocked, too.
Yeah.
But tonight, we're going to be interviewing Micah Hanks and Chris about folk devils. Basically, these are supernatural, interdimensional cryptids who have appeared on, the brink of civilizations and ushered in a time of inconvenience or like a doomsday scenario. So we're going to get into that. First, I got a couple announcements first. Nick was originally scheduled with us, but something came up. We're going to reschedule an interview with him a couple of months away, so that's all covered. Just if you were expecting Nick tonight, I just wanted to cover that briefly, but he'll be back on the show up and in contact phone.
So Nick really is a real person.
Yeah, Nick Risper really exists.
This person we schedule on that.
Yeah, and he really exists. He just had something come up, and I made him commit to a exclusive with the Men in Black book that he has coming out very soon. So we'll actually like June. So we'll get him. But he had a good reason. I'm not allowed to go into the reason, but it was, you know, it was definitely something that he had to do. and tomorrow, we're going to be interviewing a special Sunday show. We have a couple more Sunday shows after this one, and then we're going to not do Sunday shows anymore because they kind of tire you out doing two shows a week. I'm not Kevin Smith, you know. I can't do a show every week from my bed. I probably would, though, if I made some of that Kevin Smith. Anyway, I like Kevin Smith. But anywho, Nancy Red Star tomorrow, People from the Sky. That's right. She's going to be telling us about the Native Americans and the extraterrestrial stories of them meeting with the ETs and what pretty much the extraterrestrials have imparted to the Native American tribes. And we're going to get into the Native American culture and reservations and just all the stuff going on with the Native American community. Plus, the big thing is just talking about the star people talking to the natives in the untainted, clear, precise, I believe, positive experiences. I don't think there's any Native American stories that are fearful or negative of them talking to these star beings. So if these beings are still in our blood and DNA and, you know, probing us, they didn't do it to the Native Americans. So maybe it's because they're not white scared people. But, hey, that's just me.
Well, you know, dude, the Indians probably didn't try to fucking shoot them out of the sky or something, too, you know. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were like, come on down and you know, have our women toke on the pipe and hang
out.
Yeah,
they weren't firing cannons at them. And then, my last announcement before we get into the guest, February is Heartbreakers Month. Now, I don't know if I've ever talked about this before, but some of the reasons I got into radio or wanted to do radio in my teens is I saw that movie Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater. You know, Hard Harry, the Eat Me, Beat Me lady, Is It Bigger Than a Baby's Arm? I saw that as a kid, like in my teens, and I always wanted to do radio. I also used to listen to Howard Stern a lot, like way too much. I don't anymore, but back then I used to play in Florida. I would listen to it all the time, read his books. I was a harlot. So between him and that movie, that's kind of what made me want to do radio. So I'd definitely say he was an influence on some level, but I don't think I'm that demeaning towards women. Unless they're bitches, of course. Anyway, to the point, Heartbreakers Month is we're going to be interviewing guests that we don't like. Well, Guy don't like some of the guests, and, well, I don't say he doesn't like them, maybe Cal Corf, but basically Colleen Thomas next week, Saturday, at the Church of Mavis, The Exorcism of Colleen Thomas, Redemption or Excommunication. We're going to see how it goes. It's probably going to be like The Exorcist, literally.
All right, listen, dude. Listen. I'm going to go on record right now saying that Colleen is the female version of Cal Corf. She's the female Cal Corf. This next month, we will not be on the radio, I guarantee, because it will be nothing but F-bombs, train wrecks, screaming and yelling. It's just going to be mass hysteria.
We're not
going to
be on FM.
No.
My first question for Colleen is going to make her go crazy.
I'm just going to be like, hey, you know, send me some naked pictures, and then, you know, we'll talk. You know, you got to butter me up before this interview.
Do you know she got mad at Leslie Mitz and wished Leslie Mitz to get brain tumors and die in her brain? She's crazy, man. We're going to interview her. My goal is to blacklist her from the community, but we'll see how it goes. Also, Aaron McCollum, I don't really have a problem with Aaron. I think there's some, I don't know, I've read a lot of problems with Aaron McCollum, from drug allegations to, you know, shield, con man, charlatan, yada, yada, yada. I don't know. He seems passionate about a lot of things. He's always at rallies and freaking holding BP signs and stuff. So that's kind of guy.
He's part dolphin, so he can't be all bad, you know.
Well, that's going to be your stick. I'm just going to interview him normally, and if you got questions, then go for it.
here's what I'll do. I'm after the break, so we don't have that 10 minutes of awkwardness. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'll start, you know, my onslaught after the break. So it's in the second hour, I will do my. I'm not going to ambush him.
Him and Colleen Thomas just got in a big fight too. I heard he was trying to get her, but I don't know what happened with that. But yeah, and then we have John Ratcliffe, John W. Ratcliffe. He is our special news investigator. Nutter Butter News. He's going to be telling us about just all the crap going on in ufology, just all the junk, all the cheese. He's our special reporter. He's going to be with us for 2 hours. He's been on the show before, and basically we're going to talk about all the – we're going to trash talk everybody. And then to end it, hopefully, if not, I don't know, we're supposed to end it – with Cal Corf debating Guy, but Cal Corf's acting kind of weird. He didn't even give me a contact number yet. He promises that he's going to. I did a search earlier tonight. Well, listen to this. I did a search earlier tonight under your name and Cal Corf, and this thing came up at his site claiming that he's turned you into the police.
Whatever. Listen, Cal Corf, if he shows up, you know, it doesn't matter because he's not going to talk. He's not going to get to talk. It's not going to be a debate about any of his stuff. He's a liar. He's a sociopath. You know, he can make all the videos about me he wants. You know, he's just a silly, silly person. And, you know, basically we're just going to talk shit about him for two hours.
Well,
that's basically what we're going to do. And it doesn't end with him, dude, because you...
He hasn't given me a contact number, so if he doesn't, then I guess that's what we'll do. We'll do an anti-Cal Corp show. We'll
you did Michael Horn. You did Michael Horn afterwards, and that's going to, dude. That is going to be.
I don't have
probably, dude, my head will probably explode during that show.
Michael
will.
Horn.
It will.
I wanted to fit him into February, but there wasn't room. Then that's the end of all the crazy interviews. Then we try to get back serious a little bit after we destroy the entire community. But Michael Horn, I'm neutral on that. I don't know what to think about Billy Meyer. I mean, I don't really know. I wasn't there.
What?
I know. I've heard stories. I don't know. It's not just my guiltiness on a Paracast show about him. I don't know.
Dude, it had nothing to do with the Paracast. This has nothing to do with the Paracast. This has to do with Billy Meyer and his trash can UFOs hanging on string. Dude, I'm not even going
to
discuss.
You can talk to
I cannot be. We are having this conversation.
I told you, I don't know. I know a lot about Billy Meyer. I've seen a couple documentaries. I've heard that he's a con. I've heard that he's not a con. I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't there with Billy Meyer making tin can soda UFOs. So I don't know. Is it all right to not know in this field?
You should know.
I don't, but why? Based on the fact that other people say it's true? That I don't know. It could be true. I just don't know.
Dude,
I like to interview somebody and make up my own mind about them.
That's fine. Hey, man, you go ahead and do that. But, you know, he brought back a book of pictures of his trip with the UFO people back in time to the dinosaurs, and he made a photo album, and then they gave him a laser gun, and, you know, just...
Well, Michael Horn will probably go crazy, and you two can yell at each other. Well, I gotta confirm it with Michael Horn. I haven't talked to him in a while, so Cal Corp and Michael Horn are kind of up in the air. So we'll see. It should happen, but you never know. Never know until it happens, and we might have to get someone else in. But that's the schedule right now. The only thing I've seen of Billy Meyer is like some documentary I pirated somewhere. That's all. I don't know much about him. I know a little bit. But not a lot. You know more about him than I do.
Yeah, I know a lot about him.
All right. Let's get to our guest. We're done with the circle jerk. You done with the circle jerk?
I don't know. Stop using my sayings.
All right. Is our guest there? Mr. Micah Hanks and Chris Hayes. Micah Hanks, friend of the show, friend of me, friend of Guy. Are you there?
Here's Johnny, yes, the resident 4T and, you know, an erudite scholar of all things strange and supernatural. Mr. Micah Hanks, always glad to be here with you, Jeff and Guy.
The abominable Michael Hanks.
Yes.
Not been following, yes, my new section at the Mavis Incarnate Forums, the abominable Mr. Hanks. Kind of like the abominable vibes, only more evil. So, yeah, that's me. And, of course, you know, got to plug that, you know, go over and check out the forums because, you know, hey, I hang out over there, so why shouldn't you, right?
That's right. That's right. That's how we do it. All right. First off, let's get Micah. Just tell us a bit about yourself, just a little bit so the audience knows, and then let Chris say a little bit about himself, and then we'll get into folk devils.
Folk devils. We'll talk about the devil. We're going to talk about Satan for our Christian audience tonight. We're going to explore Satan.
Oh, God. We're having fun already. Yes, yes. Chris Hayes is the real guest tonight, and he's the guy that you're going to want to hear from, but I'll be happy to tell you a little bit about myself. Of course, I'm Micah Hanks of GraylianReport.com, and if you're not familiar with the Graylian Report, you have been living in a cave for the last several years, but if you want to go check that out, it's www.graylianreport.com, and also host of the weekly radio program, the Micah Hanks Program. And that broadcasts on the Patriot Brigade Talk Radio Network on Sunday nights, and I did that purposely so that it wouldn't conflict with my favorite buddy's program here, the Church of Mavis, so you can have your cake and eat it, folks. Yeah, exactly. And we're friends, you know. We're all friends of the show and everything, and we network and work together, and that's what's so great and why I've come over to the Mavis forums and started contributing my abominabilities there as well. But, yeah, I've been...
We do drugs and go to orgies together. Just kidding.
You know, I mean, you know, just the weekend stuff, you know. But I have spoken, actually, to a living anomaly, Nick Redfern. He does exist. And of course, you know, I specialize not only in the study of just 4T and weirdness, but use and my latest kick. If you want to hear me, the mouth of the South, rambling about this sort of stuff, you know, it's mostly a speculative ufology and this sort of thing as of late. But tonight, I'm going to break suit. Excuse me. I'm going to break, you know, with the ufology thing that you know, usually kind of consumes my very existence, and we're going to talk about folk devilry. But first, I'll toss it over to my good friend here, Mr. Chris Hayes, who's in studio here with me back at our Agrelian bunker in Asheville, North Carolina. I can't give you any more specific location than that. Up here in the Dark Hills, the Appalachian Mountains, we broadcast from hundreds of miles below the Earth's surface, and we're happy to give you dispatches from the lunatic fringe here tonight. So without further ado, Mr. Chris Hayes.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction, Micah. He does me too much justice. Yes, my name's Christopher Hayes. I'm an atheist religious scholar and anthropologist, hailing also from Asheville, North Carolina. This is only my second time on the radio, and I'm pleased as punch to be here.
There he is.
We're pleased to have Chris.
He's a legend.
What kind of punch?
Yeah. What kind of punch?
As a spike?
PJ, usually.
Oh, yeah, we can't tell you what we're really drinking. It's not Brass Monkey, okay?
Punch. We're on Hunch Punch right now.
Yeah. Whatever it is,
I haven't had that in, like, high school orgies.
Yeah, right, I can do those with you. Okay, go ahead. Turn it over to you, Jeff.
Well, the name of the show is Folk Devils. What are folk devils?
Okay, what are folk devils? this is a fun discussion to try and dive into, and you know, to tell you the truth, it's kind of fortuitous that Nick wasn't able to join us tonight, because you know, Nick and I, we both are you know, researchers of 4TN phenomenon. But I think that all things considered, the way that I'm trying to wrap my head around this idea of quote unquote folk devilry might be even better suited for discussion where my esteemed colleague Mr. Hayes here could join me and talk about this. You know, and I don't normally do interviews with special guests like this. Usually I'm a one-man show. I mean, as much as I talk, it's usually all that, you know, people can take listening to me ramble and, you know, about all this stuff. So, but Chris is here to help me tonight, because what I'm trying to designate with the idea of folk devils is not just, you know, the typical cryptid monstrosities, although we're going to address, you know, subjects and characters, you know, of the you know, you might call it the great grimoire of the 4TN, you know, some of these being the Gray Man, the Grinning Man, a creature called Walking Sam, the Jersey Devil, even Bigfoot and the Abominable Snowman kind of work into this mythos. And then, of course, you know, Mothman, even alien abductions. What we're talking about is, rather than the rather conventional approach to studying particularly cryptid creatures and the like, which is, you know, these might be, you know, anomalous, you know, animals, strange, mystery beasts, as yet unknown to science, that exist somewhere on the fringes of humanity, just out of reach, and somehow have actually eluded modern science. I try and, with this idea of folk devils, I look at literally what are more of the folkloric approaches to this sort of study. For instance, posted at GrayleanReport.com that talked about a 19th century folk devil, where literally a man described coming across, you know, along a country road, what sounded like a Bigfoot. But the Bigfoot spoke to him and said that it had, you know, essentially, you know, been cursed and had to wander this world for all eternity, and alluded to the fact that he was the biblical Cain. Now, most people would look at a story like that and they would talk about it, you know, as being essentially just a folk tale, you know. But I think that when it comes to studying 4TN phenomenon, every now and then, we can benefit from looking at things not so much in a nuts and bolts, you know, this is a physical creature sort of capacity, and considering things from a folkloric and a cultural perspective. That's why I like to bring up this notion of this entity that's seen among some of the Midwestern native tribes that's called Walking Sam. Walking Sam, I think it's the Ogallala Sioux who report sightings of Walking Sam. He's 12 to 15 feet tall, and curiously described as having a stovepipe hat that he wears. Cryptozoologists interpret reports of Walking Sam as being some sort of a Bigfoot-type creature, whereas, you know, the native interpretation describes it more as a tall but a very manlike being of some sort who is associated with mischief and misfortune. And you look through the history of Fortiana, and you see that with regard to reports about the Mothman and many of these other strange beings, these entities that appear, often people associate them with danger or bad luck, harbingers of some sort of misfortune. And that's kind of where the folk devil idea comes from. Now, the term, the term itself, pardon me, I'm having to clear my throat, you know, it's that time of the year where everybody gets that good old wintertime crud. But the idea, folk devil,
remember
actually,
to breathe, man.
Yeah, remember to breathe. Easy.
I forget too.
But this the folk devil idea is actually a sociological term that dates back to the 1960s of English origin, and it literally describes, you know, an example of a folk devil of that era might be, you know, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, you know, a particular group in society that is kind of blamed for society's woes. You know, if kids are going out and doing drugs and they're going to, you know, like Jeffrey Pritchett going to, you know, high school orgies and things like that, we want to find essentially a scapegoat, a modern equivalent of the old witch hunts, you know, and, you know, the Inquisition and all this sort of stuff. And again, this is why a religious scholar like Mr. Chris Hayes is going to be so useful in this discussion, because over time, there is this sort of kind of a, you know, let's find the alarmist, let's find the scapegoat. And in certain capacities, I think that Fortean monsters also can become scapegoats for society's woes much the same way. Hence, we have these Fortean folk devils. That, in a nutshell, is what we'll be discussing tonight.
Amen.
Awesome. Anything like Indian Wendigos, stuff like that?
You know, yeah, because, again, a Wendigo, you know, by according to many native traditions, actually is a human being who, of course, consumes the flesh of the living. And Chris is over here making gestures. He's biting his own arm. Here, bite my arm. Then you can be a real Wendigo. but you know, the Wendigo tradition, you know, essentially that's a, you know, a very magical, you know, mystical kind of thing where it's a human being who goes through a folkloric mystical process that turns them into something else, turns them into a beast. Whereas, looking at this from a cryptozoological perspective, we often interpret reports of the Wendigo as being, you know, one variation of the Bigfoot or the Sasquatch mythos, so to speak. You know, but then again, when we try and think about this in terms of us again, to kind of step back and say, well, obviously, you know, people who eat the flesh of other people, I mean, I've never tried it and don't ever intend on trying that myself, but I don't think that it's going to turn them into a monster. You know, but these traditions, you know, the idea of consuming, I mean, this is even something that's, you know, kind of, you know, rife through Christianity. I mean, we consume the flesh and drink the blood of our Savior. It's very vampiric, very, very strange. And, you know, there's reasons why these consistencies exist. It's almost like an archetypal thing. And in many capacities, the importance of the relationship between humankind and these Fortean folk devils may be not so much their existence or the like thereof, but that strange kind of psychological association that we make with them, what these things represent for us in terms of humanity, okay, what archetypes represent for us. And if you want to think of these creatures as being archetypes, something like that, you know, they literally are a manifestation of our fears that come together, whether or not, you know, there is an actual physical body representative of that quote-unquote creature. But yes, a Wendigo would be a good example of that kind of thing. In fact, a very, very good example.
Well, Mike, or Chris, these beings, I mean, as we know, society in itself, the Christian society and many other, I don't know about the Aramaic religion, all that stuff, Allah and all that jazz, the Christian religion blames, you know, everything that's bad or evil, every fart in the wind on the devil, you know, and that's how it's always been throughout mankind. Something bad happens, it's the devil, or God's punishing you. Now in our society, when it comes to the Christian religion, if anything bad happens, pretty much, I've gone to a church before a long time ago, and I was hanging out, you know, because I was bored eating free food. And I one day made the mistake of telling the Bible study dude that I shacked up and shagged a girl. He kicked me out, told me that I put a wedge in the group and I was going to let Satan in because of what I did.
No,
I was putting everyone in danger, and basically kicked me out of just for saying I shagged a chick. So later on, I put a piece of dog poo in his mailbox, but that's a whole other story. But anyway, the point is, society is always blaming the devil, the Christians or whatever, the devil for everything. These beings, they seem to appear And then does it seem to, in most cases, herald a time of doomsday upon the fringe of the civilization that they're seen at?
I mean, I got to jump in real quick and just say, first of all, the Satan, okay, the Christian devil probably is the first folk devil. But without further ado, I mean, this is totally Chris Hayes here. I'm gonna turn this one over to you. The devil. Is the devil like the supreme folk devil, or, you know, is he a scapegoat essentially? You know, when people want to go out and do bad stuff, the devil made me do it. It was evil sin, this sort of thing, that whole concept of Christianity.
Oh, yeah, because I don't think back then or even now many Christians have that little concept of personal accountability. Anytime wrong, you chop off your baby's arms or you stub your toe, well, the devil made me do it. And that goes as deep as exorcism and demonic possession, and as light as adultery or cheating on your taxes.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too, I mean, it's not just Christians. I mean, you know, anybody, you know, I don't want to demonize any, you know, that's the interesting thing is I am a Christian, you know, whereas, you know, Chris here, he is a theological scholar and an atheist, which is why we have this nice kind of dichotomy going here. The thing is, to me, of course, I'm not a very conventional religious type person. In fact, I think I prefer the term universal spiritualist, but that's a whole other story. Read my book. But anyway, I'll say that, you know, well, like you, Jeffrey, you know, I have a religious upbringing, and I'm a spiritual person, but I see a lot of people in the name of some sort of, you know, unseen force, you know, like you just said, Chris. It's as though personal accountability can be removed and there's something else that we can blame for the woes of society when we want to play, let's point the finger at somebody else. But even if I did it and I'm guilty, you know what? It's okay, though, because somebody or something else made me do it. And I'm not really guilty. In fact, you know, I'm willing to change my ways, you know, if you'll forget the bad stuff I've done.
Yeah, and that would be almost acceptable even up until the early 1920s. But now with things like science and observation, you can't blame something like the plague on the Jews anymore. You have to take responsibility and say, well, this is a virus. We've got to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Wasn't that great? They just, how many Jews did they kill? 20,000, something like that. They just burned them up.
Mm. Quite a few. Yeah.
Yeah, and bad.
Although I'd even go so far as to say, historically, that the Jews are an even greater, or the Jewish race is even a more pop folk devil than the devil himself, at least in Christian culture.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and again, that gets into kind of the sociological use of that term, you know, for folk devilish. I do want to make that distinction because when we're talking about this, and I'm glad you brought that up, Chris, by the way, because that is a very, accurate example. And I brought up witch hunts and things like that, you know, the Salem witch trials, you know, anyone who you can blame, you know, or any group, any, you know, I was talking to someone, for instance, you know, who told me recently that, you know, if those are folk devils, you know, the debate over and actual illegal immigrants themselves also would be representative of the folk devil element, you know, in our culture today. But what's interesting, if we take this down the road of studying Fortean folk devilry, okay, We see instances where we for instance, and probably one of the best recorded instances of this was in John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, where these encounters with folks during the late 1960s in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. I mean, it's almost blasé for me to even go into that right now because that story is so well known. But briefly, again, in case someone's not familiar with that story, John Keel had been a journalist who investigated primarily UFOs, and of course he was in the Point Pleasant area because there was a UFO flap going on there in the late 1960s. And this began to coincide with people's reports of a winged humanoid being. I think one of the earliest encounters that occurred dealt with a group of high school teenagers who had been traveling along the parkway. A lot of these reports and encounters occurred around the vicinity of this former TNT plant there in the area. And these teenagers literally seen this creature standing near the side of the road, and it lifted off of the ground and actually pursued their vehicle and at a tremendous speed for you know, a large winged creature of some kind. Then they go into town, they actually, you know, filed an official report there in town with the police department, and I believe that if I remember the circumstances correctly, the sheriff at the time, whose name slips my mind, he actually had these children, and he, they weren't really children, these young adults, and said, you know, I've known these kids their whole, my whole life, their whole lives, and I can vouch for their integrity. Something had happened. They were genuinely frightened by something. So there was, you know, what was interpreted clearly as some sort of a physical element with regard to that so-called Mothman. It didn't resemble a moth at all, but as I understand it, there was a, you know, a Batman villain, I think, and much like Sasquatch, it sounds like a native word, but that's actually an amalgamation of words that were put together by a journalist at the time. Well, the same thing happened with Mothman. That was a, you know, an amalgamation of terms that a journalist put to, or not amalgamation, but it was a term that, you know, just, it was kind of, you know, again, a kind of a pop cultural thing. You know, it was a Batman villain, if I remember correctly. And they pinned this name on the thing. Mothman terrorizes West Virginia and Point Pleasant. So this, although there is clearly what John Keel approached it, maybe somewhat from a cryptozoological standpoint, in the sense that this might be some sort of a physical creature. I think that he also kind of erred on the side of there being some sort of maybe an interdimensional. I think ultra-terrestrial was a term that they used also at the time, to describe you know, one, you know, somewhat plausible theory for this thing. I mean, really, what in the hell is this thing? You know, we don't know, but they did their best to try and discern from what little, you know, information was available about this truly bizarre set of circumstances. There's a ufological perspective where people will try to equate this with, you know, essentially a, you know, a denizen from another planet, you know, that had actually traveled here, and maybe a UFO craft of some sort. And then there's the the rather curious association that could be made with this creature. And of course, this was clearly outlined by John Keel in his book, hence the title, The Mothman Prophecies. The reason it was called Prophecies was because he and others who were researching that case have made associations between, you know, the Mothman creature and its presence being representative of an actual you know, disaster that was bound to occur, and which did occur. There was the collapse of the Point Pleasant, the Silver Bridge there, which ran over the Ohio River there at Point Pleasant, and that is actually referred to as one of the greatest, you know, disasters when it comes to, you know, the you know, engineering and structural integrity of our infrastructure here in the United States. That's considered one of the single most devastating instances in history. I mean, there's an entire Wikipedia page just about the collapse of the Silver Bridge. Many think that because, curiously, the reports of the, you know, creature, the so-called Mothman, tended to either die off or ceased altogether after the collapse of the bridge, many kind of made this connection. And Keel himself even claimed to have had some degree of knowledge prior to the disaster that this was going to happen, and that the creature was representative of some sort of misfortune, that whether it caused that misfortune or was just merely kind of its presence worked in tandem with, you know, events leading up to the collapse of the bridge itself. You know, that's another, you know, when it comes to Fortean folk devils, it's a perfect example, I think, of a mystery creature that is associated with, you know, a certain sort of set of circumstances that, of course, you know, works against humankind. Another one, and I'd forgotten all about this, but today, Chris, you mentioned the grinning man, which is another one that is associated almost solely with UFOs. Can you tell a little bit about that real quick?
Yes, generally, simply put, the story of the grinning man is usually up north. Anytime the grinning man is seen, either comes right before or right after a UFO sighting is reported. General thought on this is either the Grinning Man is a scout from the aliens, or in fact a man in black. His appearance is really unsettling, nowhere near human, if you could call it human. All of his features are really exaggerated. Huge, wide grinning mouth, no hair, no body hair at all, no nose, huge, menacing eyes, not like the almond-like, kind eyes of a gray.
I know, some people wouldn't call him kind, but yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that one, and that's another one. You know, again, this thing appears, you know, in the Men in Black. You know, the Men in Black, their appearance in conjunction with UFO sightings, and of course, the thing about the Men in Black is that they're very seldom, reports of people who claim to have had encounters with these, you know, individuals who, you know, wear the black dress, you know, very nondescript, you know, plain clothes, sort of, they dress like the Blues Brothers, essentially, you know. Very seldom do people report good experiences with these Men in Black. You know, it's just kind of a nefarious thing. They come, you know, poking around after someone's seen a UFO. They make very, very, very strange conversations, sometimes of a threatening nature. You know, have you ever had a MIB come to your house, Chris?
No, I haven't, but that brings up another point where I feel like for these Fortean folk devils, the idea of the thing, you were talking about this earlier, the idea of the thing can be much more powerful and nowhere near as accurate as the thing itself,
mm-hmm.
where there may be men in black, but the idea and the story of the men in black coming to erase your mind and take away your children because you saw an alien is far more powerful, and I think that gives the men in black, if they do exist, leeway to not even have to do anything because the idea of them is so much scarier than they actually are.
Yeah.
The job is done for them.
It's interesting because, yeah, these reports lend to this kind of mythos that sort of builds around them, and all of a sudden these beings, not to say that, you know, there aren't sightings of MIBs or sightings of Sasquatches or whatever else, but there is the... You know, this kind of deeply rooted in our culture kind of interpretation of these beings that almost, you know, kind of, I don't want to say outlives, but it's almost, you know, a more fierce and more intriguing representation than the reports themselves. So, you know, again, those are some good examples, you know, the Fortean folk devils. And I think, you know, I think it's interesting to try and approach it with that kind of a folkloric and cultural perspective of these things, because clearly not every instance of report of a big, you know, here's the thing, I get stories people tell me about Bigfoot where they say, you know, I watched this thing walking down a road, very credible reports, and they all, you know, sound just like an anthropomorphic creature, a very man-like creature, and then people say I'm watching the thing where it disappears in mid-stride. I mean, I've spoken to very, very, very learned individuals who tell these stories. What that illustrates is that many of these encounters, however strange they may be, however, you know, logical they may sound, there are occasionally instances where there are things that absolutely defy any kind of rationalization, and therefore helpful to try and interpret this every now and then from the cultural and the folkloric perspective without completely dismissing the notion of the existence of, or, you know, the possibility thereof when it comes to these creatures, you know, existing in an actual physical capacity.
What about, wasn't there an India or something, some kind of ape man or wild man or something that, like, appeared? And I'm sure there was some kind of myth around it of, like, eating people or stealing children or something.
Yeah, jumping on the roofs. Yeah, it was.
I think that's the Orang Pendek in Indonesia.
Oh no! Actually, I know what you guys are talking about. They're talking about the Monkey Man.
Oh,
yeah, that's the wow. Imagine that. It's called the Monkey Man. the Orang Pendek also, actually, and then there's another one called Orang Minyak, which is even weirder. It's not a monkey man at all. It's a guy who basically is a sexual pervert who, you know, sneaks into, you know, houses and does, you know, deviant things to young ladies. But, yeah, the man monkey specifically, and this is really interesting, that creature only appeared during periods of social unrest, okay? Same sort of idea as Zanzibar's Popobawa, which is a winged demon. It's actually a demonic rapist. And there's a very curious kind of consistency between people's reports. The Orang Minyak, okay, for instance. It's funny that you brought up, actually, Chris, because that reminds me of Orang Minyak, this being literally a spirit-like personage that comes in people's houses and sexually molests them. We have the Popobawa, which is a demonic creature in Zanzibar and other locales who is, you know, allegedly comes in people's windows at night and sexually molests them. We have many people who claim that there are, you know, both incubi and succubi, and people who have experienced the so-called sleep paralysis also describe there being a sexual set of circumstances that can sometimes be associated with that also. So it's funny because some of these folk devils only appear or tend to appear, you know, generally when there seems to be some sort of social unrest that's occurring at the time. And, you know, they tend to attack us, so to speak, at our very weakest points, you know. And I think that, you know, you look at, like, for instance, people getting really upset about, you know, the screenings with the TSA having to get on airplanes and stuff. And the reason why people are, of course, you know, bothered by that is the fact that, you know, they're being touched in places, you know, the don't touch me spots, you know, the no-go zones. that really hits home with people, and it is something that is, you know, the invasive aspect of that psychologically has a greater impact than the actual physical activity. People, you know, they can go through the screening, they'll be fine, but the thought of it's what bothers them. And you hear these reporters talking about for hours and even days after the fact, shuddering, having gone through these, you know, pat-down procedures and things. It seems to be the very same thing with these folk devils. Some of them, they either are literally caused by and appear in accordance with social unrest in a given locale, or they actually have a greater psychological impact on the people who are affected in these areas than the actual physical presence of the creature itself.
So you think those get moved from like culture to culture, like in India it's called one thing, and in Tunisia it's called another thing, but it does the same thing. I mean, do you think those legends transcend, you know, culture and countries and that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I feel like, especially in the concept of the Orang Mendek and the succubus and the incubi, the succubus and the incubi, those are both represented in Kabbalistic Jewish culture as well as in Christian culture. I think the fear of being raped in your sleep is pretty universal, and it probably does stem from, say, just in this instance, the sleep paralysis, where you're in that state between sleep and wakefulness when you physically can't move because your brain hasn't woken up yet.
Right. Oh, yes. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the fact that this kind of a terrifying, invasive attack on oneself, you know, occurs in a sleep state where people, you know, and not to say that maybe there isn't some sort of a, you know, spirit, you know, aspect, a spiritual aspect of sorts that could be associated with sleep paralysis. My good friend Louis Proud from Australia wrote a book called, I always do this. I get on the show and I read so many books that I don't want to say the title of it wrong. Dark Intrusions, trying to remember the subtitle of it, but Dark Intrusions deals with, I think it's actually a paranormal investigation of sleep paralysis is what it's called. But anyway, Dark Intrusions deals with Louis's own experiences with, you know, sleep paralysis experiences where he believed that he had actually had interactions with spiritual beings. I reviewed the book for me. Now, let me just guess. He thanked me very much for the, there we go. Yeah, Chris has got the title. Actually, would you read the complete title there and make sure I didn't butcher it there?
Yes, it's Dark Intrusions, subtitle, An Investigation into the Paranormal Nature of Sleep Paralysis Experiences.
There you go. I knew paranormal was in there someplace. But he thanked me for the review I'd written, and then he jumped in there after the fact and said, oh, and by the way, I can tell that you don't believe in, like, the spiritual aspect of this. You think it's a physiological phenomenon, obviously. So I want to tell your listeners, Guy and Jeff, that, you know, first of all, again, you know, Chris and I tonight, our purpose isn't to say none of this stuff is real. I'm saying suspend judgment, looking at it differently, because, see, I might have my own perspectives and my own beliefs when it comes to studying the unexplained, but every now and then I've found that I learn more personally if I suspend my own judgments and my own perceptions and my own concept of what these things represent, you know, physically.
I have something for a question for Chris. When we talk about these beings as far as being demonic and, you know, some of these you know, succubuses and these creatures, how does this fit into your view of atheism? What do you think they are as far as from an atheist point of view?
It's a good question.
Well, coming from my point of view, I tend to look at things a lot more logically than most people do, because one of the tenets of my, I guess, lack of religion is to not take anything at face value at all. So I employ logic in everything. And like I said earlier, at least in as far as the succubus and the incubus, it is that state between wakefulness and sleep where your brain is still emitting the paralyzing hormones, the thrashing about and killing yourself in your sleep. And
I try and strengthen myself every night.
And your eyes are open at the same time, so you're experiencing horrible, frightening hallucinations, and you've got no reference point for that. So you attribute it to whatever, regardless of your culture. If you're Christian, you would attribute that to a demon. If you live in a more animalistic society, you would attribute that to a spirit monster or some sort of anthropomorphic animal. And then in a broader sense, it's what I said, where you only have a certain reference point depending on your culture, so you attribute it to whatever you can when you don't have anything else to go against.
Yeah, nothing else to draw from. See, that's, again, the whole point. You know, I think we have to look at this stuff because, Guy, I think you brought it up a moment ago. Does every culture have one of these? You know, in you know, India, we had this monkey man thing, you know, and then, of course, you know, it was the Malay cultures, I guess, that talk about, you know, some of these creatures like, you know, what's that thing called, a Kurupi, that my friend and fellow researcher Christopher McCollum taught me about of Central America. Here in America, of course, with the native tradition, we have Sasquatches and Bigfoot, Wendigo, another one that you brought up there, Guy. Cultures do have different interpretations of, maybe not spirit beings, some cultures might call them spiritual because they seem, again, to exist outside what we, I guess, as humans kind of define as reality. But recognizing and understanding the different cultural interpretations, rather than taking that at face value, writing down a bunch of books and talking about a ghost in Thailand, a alien in the United States, a monster in Africa, you know, we could be talking about one singular phenomenon. But different reports and the different, you know, culminations of this information could manifest as a result of the kind of cultural screen through which this phenomenon is interpreted. So I think that's kind of an interesting way to look at this. And again, I emphasize the importance, and it's cool because, you know, you've got the anthropological background also. So looking at this, you know, I'm talking to Chris here, but Chris having an anthropological background, you can look at this perspective, you know, or from the perspective of cultures interpreting perhaps what could be a singular phenomenon. Kind of reminds me like the old idea of Charles Fort saying, you know, that there's like this, whatever it is, this presence, and humankind, we're kind of its plaything, you know, we're like the toys, we're owned by something, you know.
You know, I would probably be a full-blown atheist right now, but, you know, I've had five, six, seven experiences that, you know, there is no logical explanation, you know, wide awake, I'm physically moved, physically touched, things you can't see, and it's just something that really just can't wrap your head around. You know what I mean? I mean, there's no launching point or reference point, like you were saying before with the sleep paralysis. There's no reference point for me to deal with that.
And yeah, that's totally understandable. I might be in the same boat as you. I just haven't had any of those experiences so far. And it may be, I was speaking with Micah a few months ago, that it may be that I'm not looking for any sort of experience like that. If it happens to me, great, but I'm not really seeking it out right now. That may change in the future. But I mean, if you have those experiences and you've got nothing else to attribute them to, then by all means, until proven otherwise, attribute them to whatever you wish. I just haven't had the luck of having sort of experience like that.
You know, what's funny about that, guys, is, you know, here I call myself a ufologist. I'm like the lamest guy in the world. You know, I'm one of these guys who have never seen a UFO, you know, never seen a ghost, never seen a chupacabra running around or a Bigfoot or anything. I've never had anything like that happen. Now, I have had the guy talking, I think, you know, maybe speaking more along the lines of what you're, you know, associating with there also, maybe things that I would say were spiritual experiences. I would even say that at times, you know, I've had thoughts at very, you know, pivotal moments enter my mind that literally, I think I heard, you know, the country and bluegrass singer Ricky Skaggs refer to this as a download from the mother throne. You have this profound thought that literally in mind as though, you know, coming from someplace else, as though kind of handed to you and given to you. You know, maybe there is a certain kind of divine interaction, or however you want to word that. You know, I certainly have had spiritual things like that happen, but it's interesting because for me, when it comes to UFOs or Bigfoot or the 4TN, you know, studies, I've never experienced something. For a lot of people, the experience is the gateway into wanting to learn more, that quest for knowledge. For me, I think that what drives me the most is knowing that as a human being, there has to be so much more out there, and to think that I understand the entire universe, you know, from my humanistic perspective, I mean, that's cutting myself off from all possibility to assume something so great. But by the same token, having not yet had an experience of my own drives me to want to study this stuff so much more, which, again, I'd have to say brings me back to looking at cultural interpretations. I think that we can stand to learn a lot about 4TN phenomenon and the like from trying to see it from a different perspective. You know, maybe not just, you know, from the perspective of a person 100 years ago or a person on the other side of the world, but, you know, also maybe even how we would interpret this if we were not human beings. You know, how would a cat interpret this? How would how would a space alien interpret some of the theological phenomenon that we're talking about here? Bigfoot, UFOs, creatures, and things like that. It's interesting stuff, and it's kind of mind expanding in a very non psychedelic way.
and expanding on that point. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I was just going to say it's funny you talk about animals, because in two of the experiences, my animals were directly involved and were interacting with whatever was happening. And that's actually, I think, the reason why I'm sitting here with three dogs and a cat right now is because they're like my, I think deep down I got some early warning thing going on with them, that they'll let me know when things are starting to happen or something like that. I don't know. It was a very surreal experience, and it's something that I always wonder if what happened to me is happened to other people, and they have a name for it somewhere. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. So. Absolutely. And bringing it back to something like sleep paralysis, it's funny because you hear about night hags, you hear about devil riding your back. Every culture, there's a very well-known researcher, Dr. David Hufford, PhD. I interviewed him a few years ago, and he's probably one of the foremost experts, on studying sleep paralysis as, again, a physiological phenomenon, whereas my friend Louis Proudhon, in his book Dark Intrusions, he kind of explores it from a paranormalist perspective. An investigator of the unexplained tries to tackle this from a supernatural perspective of the phenomenon. David Hufford, on the other hand, he's experienced sleep paralysis. Hell, I mean, I've experienced sleep paralysis myself, having had knowledge of what I, and what some of the scientific interpretations of that phenomenon are prior to the experiences. Of course, I had an idea of what was happening, and I didn't freak out. In fact, there was nothing about those experiences that to me seemed overtly supernatural, whereas some people say, well, let me tell you about my experience, and I've had some really, really weird stuff told to me by people who've had their own encounters during that, I would refer to it as a sleep state. But what's fascinating culturally about it, again, every culture has its own interpretation, and most of them describe something like, a old hag or a devil riding your back, something like that. And it usually is some sort of a nefarious character who is literally, on top of your chest and trying to suck your soul out of your body. And for that matter, there's a incredible, I probably don't have enough time right now to get into this, because I think we may be coming to the end of a segment, but literally many of the reports that people talk about with regard to aliens and UFOs are so similar to sleep paralysis experiences. And again, what are the aliens, in popular interpretation of that phenomenon doing? They're coming down, they're taking people's souls out, there's a whole faction of individuals out there, and that'd be great to talk to Nick Redfern about with the book Final Events, people who think that, UFOs are a demonic phenomenon of some sort, So, again, it's interesting that every culture has their own interpretation, and that there's such similarity between these interpretations from culture to culture, and yet they're different enough to where some people actually look at them and categorize them as different phenomenon.
Right.
Have you, there was an article recently I put on my Facebook wall called The Alien Hand Phenomenon, and this lady, her hand would, try to hurt her and undo her blouse and stuff, and I was just thinking about the sex thing. The alien hand attacks me all the time when I'm half asleep and tries to pleasure me.
Well, if it's like Evil Dead 2, it takes a chainsaw and tries to
give me back my hand.
Yeah.
I get attacked by the alien hand every night.
You like it. You like it.
Yeah. I'm half asleep. But
On that note, we got 2 minutes, man.
What about Egypt? Going to a break.
Well, we were talking about earlier, I think our guest last week was spoke about the djinn, or the djinn, from the Middle Eastern side of things. And, to me, it looks like the djinn is something that was the launching pad for all of the you know, the demons and stuff like that, and Lucifer falling from heaven, and it's the same story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, like the jinn were basically, Rosemary said that she, that it's possible that they can appear as some of these things. Like the jinn is a Bigfoot. The jinn could appear as an alien. Like, it was pretty fascinating. You have to listen to it. I can't wait to read the book, but definitely the jinn thing, there's something to it. And there were some parallels between the angels falling from heaven and the story of the jinn.
Yeah, it's the same story. Exactly.
It happened a lot, actually, in Middle Eastern and Near East religions, where in the Epic of Gilgamesh, they speak of a great flood. In the Bible, they speak of the great flood. Even in North American, Native American cultures, there is a great flood story. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these kinds of things, I'm not sure if it's word of mouth spreading across the world or if people are having the same sort of epiphanies at the same time. But it's really weird and groovy when you see all the same similar stories pop up at the same time on opposite ends of the globe.
I think if the time stories originated, you know, the Earth was a different place back then. I mean, it was probably the end of an ice age. There was land masses that were here that are no longer here. You know, and I think you know, there's a lot of stuff was going on. I mean, just stuff like that. You know, in the Pacific Northwest, all the Indian tribes up there have a story about a thunderbird. You know, this is like 6,000 years old story where a thunderbird attacked the whole West Coast, and it was from a huge earthquake. It was a very large, you know, tsunami that hit the, you know, the West Coast of the United States, and they went through and they went through the soil record and they found where it happened. You know, so. Mm-hmm. So sure enough, man, I mean, there could have been some huge, huge, massive earthquake like there was in Sri Lanka, you know, 6-7 years ago, and had something like that happen where it just worldwide just took out like a bunch of different places.
It serves as a tremendous emphasis for all kinds of transportation and stuff.
Are we back? Hello?
Start talking.
Oh, we're back. Welcome back to the Church of Mavis. We're your hosts, Jeffrey Pritchett and Guy Weddle.
Woo!
My alien hand just got through talking to me. Tried to unbutton my pants.
It's all hairy.
I just peed off my front porch and looked at the stars.
That's great, man. Dude.
Are Micah Hanks and Chris Hayes here?
Absolutely, in the flesh. Well, at least in spirit, right?
We are drinking booze or something.
Man, we're actually drinking ayahuasca. No, we're drinking it's herbal tea tonight, actually. Yeah, down here at the Graylian bunker. So, you know, you got to drink something hot, man. It gets cold. Actually, it's not too cold. It's chilly, but I mean, it's a good constant temperature this far down under the earth all year round. Kind of like the Batcave, you know. You don't want your computers to
right.
get. We have to have dehumidifiers and everything to keep the computers from succumbing to the moisture. But otherwise, it's not too bad down here.
Laser.
What about that smiling man? That's some creepy stuff, you know. Well, I keep seeing him, like, running in this big smile. He's like the smiley face, have a nice day, and he's just running.
Yeah.
Did you do
a Google image search on the grinning man? Is that what they call him, the Grinning Man, Chris?
The Grinning Man.
I have John Keel's book, and I know I've read something about him in there, one of his books.
Yeah, and the funny thing is there's a whole lineage of creatures and personages that are like that. You know, there's, in addition to the Grinning Man, when Chris brought that up when we were discussing this sort of subject earlier today, we also talked about, I mentioned what's that guy called, the Gray Man. This is a South Carolina ghost who always appears in conjunction with a bad storm, you know, or a hurricane that might ravage the coast. And Chris just pulled up a photograph of the alleged grinning man. I think that's actually an early promo shot for the Batman film, but the Joker. But anyhow,
looking at that same one right now.
Oh, weird!
It's horrifying, man. That's the first thing I ever pulled up.
Yeah.
I looked for him. It scares me to this day.
That is terrifying. But yeah, the Gray Man, like the Grinning Man, always, you know, appears in conjunction with certain circumstances, and there's always this negative aspect of it. There's the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, which was, you know, again, Jerry Clark and some of the well-known researchers, you know, have included these in their compendiums like that over the years and refer to them as cryptid beings, you know. But
Mad Gasser?
Yeah, are you familiar with
Mad Gasser?
Mad Gasser, yeah. Not talking about farts or anything here, yeah.
No, listen to this story. This is a true story. I just put it on my wall from the United Kingdom Telegraph newspaper. Basically, the dictator jerk-off of Africa just is trying to pass legislation to make it illegal to fart in the streets of Africa. I swear to God. It's on my page. Everyone was laughing about it. I got, like, hundreds of comments on it, but basically, they're trying to make it illegal. You cannot pass wind in Africa or you go to jail. Pass wind, you go straight to jail. The guy's crazy, apparently. You know,
does that mean they're going to spend citizen tax dollars to build special fart rooms on the side of the street?
Yeah. There's signs of dudes farting with a little X through them. But tell us, that's just insane. I mean,
it's a little country. It's a little African country, but the guy is like, he wants upstanding, proper citizens. You know, it's like colonial.
He can't even fart around the place.
Yeah.
So maybe the Mad Gasser will appear.
Maybe the Mad Gasser will appear, yes. This is going to be the anti-hero of that area.
So who is the Mad Gasser?
Mad Gasser of Mattoon was essentially this character that would that was occasionally seen, you know, peering in windows at people. I'm trying to remember the period, the decade.
The 1940s.
It was the 1940s. Okay, it was the 1940s. The Mad Gasser was sometimes associated with an individual. Sometimes it was just that people would be sitting in their living rooms and they'd be feeling sick or queasy like that, and there'd be, you know, small puncture wounds, you know, or not wounds, but punctures through the screen windows and things where it looked like a device might have been slid carefully into the crack between the window, and people, you know, someone or something had tried to allow poisonous gases into one's home. The description of this individual had been that this character wore a very slick, very tight-fitting kind of a jumpsuit, sometimes some sort of a little skull cap. I mean, really, it's almost precariously similar in a way. Is that an oxymoron to say precariously similar? It's rather precarious, I guess, the fact that there are similarities, I think that's how I'm trying to word it, between the description of the jumpsuit character, you know, the tight-fitting jumpsuit, and descriptions around that same time of the early contactees and, you know, and their encounters with, you know, space brothers and aliens who would often be wearing these same sort of suits. The funny thing about this idea of a Mad Gasser is that some people have speculated there never was an individual terrorizing people by, you know, slipping gases into their homes and trying to poison them and whatnot. It was people's collective paranoia, okay, that manifested around the possibility that there was some sort of a, you know, boogeyman out there trying to harm people like the by night. And that seems to be, and that's what's kind of interesting about the nature of Fortean phenomenon. I mean, obviously, there are reasons why, for instance, a cat burglar might prefer to try and break into a building and steal the, you know, the Hope Diamond, you know, in the middle of the night. The reason why is because by dark, okay, you know, he can move about and he's less likely to be seen. If you enter a building in the middle of the evening, you know, they're going, you know, it's less likely, with the exception of security guards and the like, that there are going to be people moving around that are going to notice this individual and see what they're going to do. there almost becomes this point where you can argue that the best way to, you know, get away with something nefarious like that is to do it in broad daylight and try and hide what you're doing right out in the open, you know, as opposed to drawing attention to it by being, you know, subversive and secretive. It's interesting, therefore, that, you know, when we talk about reports of people's, you know, alleged abduction by alien beings, extraterrestrials or whatever these things piloting these so-called UFO craft are, these reports often occur, at night. People are taken out of their beds, you know, from their homes. There's this, and we'd mentioned, you know, people's experiences where they describe, you know, this, you know, the fear of you know, violation and the sexual of a lot of these experiences and encounters. You know, people who are taken aboard UFO craft, going all the way back to the Betty and Barney Hill abduction episodes. You know, they described an overtly sexual nature of the with regard to the examinations that were performed on them. You know, and it's funny because, again, culturally, at least in terms of Western culture, there with regard to UFOs. There is a certain consistency, and if we look at other cases and other reports, you know, I know that the Antonio Villa-Boas case, you know, here we are on the other side of the world. This individual was allegedly taken aboard an alien spacecraft. I believe it was the 1950s when that took place, and he claimed that what happened to him was he was literally taken aboard this craft. His clothing was removed. He was covered in some sort of a strange liquid. And then he was introduced to an alien being, a woman, who he actually, had sexual relations with there on board this
fornicated.
Yeah, fornicated. You know, it's interesting because, you know, there's a certain consistency with reports from around the world, you know, that seem to involve that ufological perspective. And some people, you know, go ahead.
Sorry. Didn't that dude, like, die later?
He died of peculiar... I don't know if it was cancer or if there were other peculiar, form of disease, but yeah, he did.
It was an alien clap.
You know, that I think is actually a theory that has been, you know, proposed, is that, you know, something that he came into contact with regard to.
That's what happens when you shag the strange, man. You get some of that alien clap.
All her irradiated juices.
Yes, exactly. You have to be careful with all of that, so. Yeah, but...
hey, all right, what were you saying about this?
Interstellar contraception. Yeah, that's what we need. But,
a little protection. You got to suit it up when you're going to get some alien poontang, you know.
Sure, make sure you put on your silver-clad, you know, skin-tight jumpsuit before you get your...
Closing it up. So what does this chick look like? Was she hot? She have three tits or what? What she look like?
Well, the accounts differ. You know, some people say that she was the most bodacious-looking blonde you've ever seen, with slightly Egyptian-looking eyes, that she barked like a dog, and that, you know, that there's, and this is all true factual, you know, according to...
She barked like a dog?
She did, yes. This is which is interesting, because there are other reports of people's encounters with alleged alien beings where they describe a vocalizations, I don't know if you can call it language, but vocalizations that could be compared to either a seal barking, a dog barking, or even a hiccup noise made by a human, so... Kind of interesting.
Just describing my girlfriend right now, man. Sorry about that guy. Yeah. You
know. We know the same girl, don't we?
Yeah, I think we do, man. Definitely.
Taking
the neighborhood. All the neighborhood dogs were howling. Man, she was crazy.
So the liquid, was that like some kind of alien KY that she used on this gentleman? So he died. I've heard this story before.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have actually died. Now, this is where, again, you know, I'm telling people when we're talking about this idea of folk devils, you know, as a matter of fact, Chris actually pointed out more accurately, this discussion has to do with Fortean folk devils because, you know, there's certainly a sociological sort of phenomenon here. And that's why I'm actually taking a sociological kind of perspective and cultural perspective and applying that to Fortean studies. It's almost more of a thought exercise we're engaging here, because the important thing about these deaths associated with people and their encounters aboard alien craft, or, you know, close encounters, you know, the fourth kind, I guess, or maybe it's actually the CE5s where they, you know, either have interaction with beings or see a landed craft approach it, and maybe even some claim to have been taken aboard. Many of these individuals who've had close encounters with an actual alien craft do develop radiation sickness and radiation poisoning. I know that with the Cash Landrum sighting in the 1980s, Betty Cash she'd gotten out of her car to observe this craft. It was in January, very cold outside, but she said that the heat irradiating off of this craft floating there above the road literally made it so that she could stand outside in the middle of the night, and it was in the bitter cold of January. She was quite comfortable being outside. She tried to get back in her car. The metal handle of her door getting back into her vehicle was so hot to the touch that she had to cover her hand to be able to get back in the car. Within hours, she was, you know, showing all the classic signs of radiation sickness, and later she developed a number of different manifestations of cancer and died. And she did die. So the point is, to be brief here, the alien, you know, encounters often do result in a physical a physical sickness that occurs, usually through as a result of radiation. So clearly there's something physical about the nature of these kinds of circumstances. But by the same token, with regard to alien abduction, I'm going to be called a pariah when I say this, but there's very little. Go ahead, Jeff. But there's very little physical scientific evidence to try and quantify and understand people's claims. And yet this is something that is so blindly, truly accepted as a part of the greater UFO mystery. I think that really, if we step back and say, okay, in the lack of scientific evidence, what can we understand about this culturally that might help us solve the mystery? So
I got a question. Wasn't there a lady or a family that got burned by UFOs with radiation, and they later on tried to sue the government or something weird?
I think that was the Cassandra.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of helicopters showed up. When they were on the road, it was a lady and her daughter. When they were on the road and stopped, and the craft came over, when the craft left, a ton of helicopters flew by and were following it. They went home. She had burns all over her body. The daughter had burns. Their fingerprints were burned into like the steering wheel and the dashboard. Before they could really pursue it, you know, with the government, because the government just stalled them and stalled. I mean, they all died. They died of, you know, cancer and all sorts of unpleasant things. I don't remember who that was. Michael, no, I don't know.
Yeah, Betty Cash, and then Vicky Landrum, I think was her name, and Vicky's grandson was in the car also, and they'd been coming back from dinner, and it was at night, and I think that this was the early 1980s, I believe. And as they were traveling along, they saw a diamond-shaped craft hovering over the middle of the road, literally with plumes of smoke and fire coming out of an area at the base of the craft. It was Betty Cash that got out of the car and tried to, you know, observe this craft. And unfortunately, they weren't very experienced in the matter of nuclear technology, which is in all likelihood probably what the power source for this craft was, which lent itself to a lot of people's perspective that this craft, whatever it was probably some sort of U.S. government craft. Certainly didn't sound like one because of the shape of it, you know, but it lent its idea itself to the notion that, you know, because it is known that, you know, for instance, during the 1960s, Douglas MacDonald and various other engineering, companies and the like were subcontracted by the U.S. government to engage in research with the hope of building and utilizing nuclear energy for aircraft. Now, when I spoke with Stanton Friedman, who's probably one of the foremost experts on that sort of regard to nuclear craft and the like, when I spoke with Stanton, I asked him about that, you know, and the likelihood that this was actually some sort of a nuclear craft, so to speak. And he said, trust me, I work for I'm probably going to mess it up either way, but you know what I'm talking about. He said, I worked for them in the 1960s, fresh out of college. He was a contemporary of Carl Sagan, had gone to University of Chicago there and everything. And he says, I went and worked for Douglas MacDonald. And I'll tell you right now, we studied that stuff. To my knowledge, there was never an actual nuclear-powered aircraft that was designed and used. Whatever that thing was not ours. And the black helicopters that Betty Cash and Vicky Landrum saw taken off after it, they were ours, but they were probably interested in it and following it because it wasn't ours, and they wanted to know what the hell that thing was.
Yeah, and one of the things was that it was on a holiday, I think, too, and they were like, well, the people were saying, well, it couldn't have been black helicopters or it couldn't have been ours because all our guys were on leave. You know, they told them some BS like that or something like that. You know what I mean? But, I think it was on a holiday. Labor Day or something like that, 4th of July, or I don't know.
Let me see here.
Let's get back on the folk devil thing, I guess. That's an interesting story. It's kind of saddening. But oh, yeah. Tell us, who are some other folk devil, like, what about Jersey Devil? Is there any, is there a folk devil?
I think the Jersey Devil, if we want to look at the Jersey Devil from a folkloric perspective, and of course, Chris, you're familiar also with the Jersey Devil character, right?
Vaguely,
okay. Yeah, he and I are bringing different subjects to the table, you know. Again, you know, the Grinning Man was a good one, and I didn't know as much about the, I bet he probably knows more about it than he thinks he does, but anyway, the Jersey Devil is a good example of a folk devil in the sense of actual folklore, American folklore, because there are stories, you know, which essentially amount to folk tales that would equate this mother. What was the famous name? Miss Leeds, you know, and old lady Leeds, you know, according to the legend, said, "I didn't want to have any more children, and you know, if I get pregnant again, then it'll may be the devil himself." Well, the child is born according to legend, and sure enough, this thing emerges that, you know, resembles kind of like an anthropomorphic horse with bat wings, and it comes screeching out and runs up the chimney and escapes off into the Pine Barrens there of New Jersey. And so hence we have this Jersey Devil. And the story, now so there are some you know, incidents where, you know, in terms of researching this as a cryptozoological phenomenon, you know, in other words, researching a physical creature that is, you know, potentially exists but is unknown at present to science. Cryptozoologists, including the various Mr. Lauren Coleman, good friend of mine, a very, very, very intelligent guy. Coleman, you know, has collected some of the stories. I think that Coleman also would draw a distinction between a lot of the legend that sort of surrounds that particular character. And would you know, tell you that that's, you know, folklore. Jerry Clark, also former editor of Fate magazine, and, you know, probably one of the most prolific scholars of the Fortean research.
So there's been no actual sightings of it by anyone?
What I was going to say is I think that there have been some credible sightings that the cryptozoologists and the like would describe. Chris, do you actually have access to any of the reported sightings? Is such a thing mentioned?
Yes, it looks like there's a few sightings from a Commodore Stephen Decatur in the 1800s and Joseph Bonaparte, Napoleon's oldest brother, in 1820.
Oh, really? And this is an American phenomenon, of course, you know. But again, you know, they hail from that period of time, and not to say that they weren't true. You know, it's like our 19th century folk devil, you know, the interpretation. Well, that thing's called the Jersey Devil, and it's actually considered some sort of a devilish creature. Again, we have a 19th century encounter with what might be a quote-unquote Bigfoot, and what does the guy describe the thing as being, you know, the biblical Cain. It's interesting that from that period, again, this cultural interpretation emerges that equates these things with, you know, the antithesis of the good Christian, you know, people here in America.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, isn't there some kind of comparison with the Nephilim and Bigfoot on some level? Like the giants, and have people try to compare them to, like, as one and the same or something?
Yeah, people, you know, I mean, some people, again, you know, if you want my personal, you know, opinion, it's sort of a fundamentalist, that's not really fundamentalism per se, but there is, you know, the literal interpretation that you could use of the biblical text, you know, for instance, you know, the line, in those days there were giants in the earth, and some people interpret that literally to mean that they're, were giants. And for all I know, again, you know, I mean, in the Christian Bible, that could be a folkloric perspective of an actual real phenomenon occurring on planet Earth that, you know, ancient people trying to, you know, make sense of and try and understand, equated with literal, what would you call it, you know, gods coming from the skies, okay, you know, impregnating Earth women. This is something that we see in, you know, a lot of different, you know, mythologies and folklore from, you know, previous cultures, even prior to Christianity. But nonetheless, yeah, the Nephilim, I think, have been equated with, you know, interpretation of giants that existed and may still exist today. There's some very interesting points made about that in Coleman's new book, Lauren Coleman and Mark A. Hall's book, True Giants.
Interesting. The thing with, you know, there's stories of Bigfoot, you know, taking chicks and shagging them and having babies and stuff.
Again, there's that sexual element, the sexualized element.
You look at Maxim magazine, do you blame them?
yeah, I can't blame them, actually.
But, okay, well, are there any other folk devils who have heralded something negative or bad happening besides Mothman and, you know, some of these other ones we've talked about, Smiling Man? Are there any other big stories?
There's also stories out of Central and South America of the Chupacabra, and to go back to the universality of some of these horrible folk devils, the Jersey Devil and Chupacabra share a lot of features that they're blamed for the killing and draining of livestock blood and horrible crop failures and all of that. It's in those, you know, if you live in New Jersey, you've got the devil. If you live in isolated South America, you've got some weird goat vampire.
Yeah. Well, you know, that, of course, granted, now that he's interested in the goat vampire. The earliest reports of the Chupacabra actually stem from Puerto Rico. Here's where it gets kind of interesting. I think it was the late 1980s that people were talking about these things, but I remember reading in Jacques Vallée's book Confrontations about a variety of UFO that were accosting people. I don't remember what part of the world, but obviously it was a Latin American country. They called these particular UFOs that would appear, and they would fire a little beam of light that would, you know, cause a puncture wound, and sometimes actually, you know, cause these people to fall ill and actually die. They called them chupas, and I think the reason being, if I remember correctly, I guess chupa would translate to meaning sucking or maybe even stealing. You know, my Spanish isn't that good, but Chris, actually, you aren't bilingual, also, are you? You erudite scholar of Fortean lore, are you?
Well, not in Spanish, but I know there's a sucker, a popular lollipop called Chupa Chups.
Oh, okay,
so,
really?
So chupa, I mean, the common factor is sucking.
Yeah, exactly. So we're talking about all this sucking here and everything. You know, it's funny because the chupacabra, of course, is called the goat sucker, but there were these UFOs that were also called chupas because the natives that were encountering these things, we believe that these things were here trying to steal our souls, take something from us. So yeah, there's that Latin American kind of interpretation, which is, you know, that works in tandem with the Western view that has emerged. I don't know how accurate this is at all, but, you know, with regard to ufology, the idea that aliens, so to speak, are here to actually rob us of our soul. Bob Lazar, who claimed to work at Area 51, you know, at the Grim Lake site out there in Nevada, Bob Lazar had claimed that, you know, that you had to be careful because some of the stuff that he had been exposed to while working at that clandestine location described humans as containers of something, containers for something, and that you know, essentially kind of constituted the interest that extraterrestrial aliens had in humankind. They were interested in getting something from us, and that we were containers that carried that. And he could only speculate that it was a religious debate and a spiritual debate that would describe exactly what it was that they were after, but that it may have, you know, constituted the human soul. Vampires, you know, they're trying to, you know, drink our blood and turn us into unholy living dead. You start seeing again, you know, that there are a lot of, you know, parallels and consistencies. These things are trying to either steal us away from our homes at night, you know, whether it's Bigfoot, you know, that's actually trying to get into a person's home and, you know, maybe not into their home, but there are reports, especially from the Native American traditions, that describe these things. You know, kidnapping women, you know, for purposes of breeding with them, you know, taking them back to their caves, whether it's, you know, Papa Baba flying in your window and molesting you, or Orang Minyak, or the Monkey Man, you know, or an alien coming in and extracting, you know, sperm and eggs and literally trying to make you the unwilling participant of an intergalactic hybridization program. I mean, you start seeing, again, culturally, those are, you know, these are all elements that are fairly consistent. Even the 19th century folk tales, you know, fairies and things, you know, little people that fly around. Nick Redfern pointed this out to me recently, you know, little people who fly around and, you know, want to take you back to their fairy kingdom and, you know, have you marry their daughter, you know, kind of the same thing again.
You know, like, yeah, that's not hard enough with bills. You got weird mutants trying to hump you all the time. Come on.
Maybe you do. Maybe you do. Jeffrey, you got weird mutants trying to hump you all the time?
Jeffrey has some issues down there in Florida. I can attest to that. Hey, what about stuff like Spring Hill Jack in London? I mean, that involved ripping people's clothes off and sneaking around and...
I think that's a perfect example. Yeah. Again, you know, we have this nefarious character. You know, there were some slightly supernatural elements that were associated with Spring Hill Jack. Spring Hill Jack kind of, You know, he was said to have been able to belch flames or breathe fire. He also, well, obviously, I mean, as the name entails, Spring Heeled Jack, he claimed he was able to leap. You know, he didn't claim, but the people who had seen this character, you know, claimed that he could leap over 12-foot, 15-foot tall walls. And there were some very credible reports of people who encountered, you know, this individual who wore, you know, some sort of, I think some of the reports describe a metallic-like armor and some sort of a helmet and also, you know, claw-like, you know, Freddy Krueger-type gloves that he could use to slash their stuff. And Chris here actually found a nice early rendition from one of the old Penny Dreadfuls of Spring Heeled Jack, kind of with like a Batman-looking cape and everything. But so, yeah, that was a folk devil. When I, you know, that was actually, you know, in addition to trying to incorporate a sociological kind of view of some of this Fortiana into some of my own research, Spring Heeled Jack may have been one of the very first characters that I was that I began to research that lent itself to the idea of a quote unquote Fortean folk devil. So, you know, Guy, that's funny that you bring that up because, yeah, that's certainly one of the you know, I think, you know, that would become a mainstay of this sort of, you know, field of study. And another one, I think, you know, even though this is in tandem with Bigfoot, but Chris and I had mentioned today earlier the abominable snowmen, you know. And the idea of, you know, yep, there you go. I think he's got it. What's that? Yeah, leaping freaks, jumping jacks, and what was it?
Phantom attackers.
Phantom attackers. I should know. I wrote that article. Yeah, but yeah, Chris has pulled up one of my articles. Phantom attackers over at the Graylian Report, you know. And you can, if you type in phantom attackers in the search bar at graylianreport.com, I think you could find this. But I talk about Spring Heeled Jack there. But the reason I bring up the abominable snowman is because, again, we have a report of a Bigfoot type creature, you know, and the Sherpas there in the Himalayas, they definitely say that there's a mystical kind of an interrelationship that they have with, you know, these creatures. There's the, you know, some of them consider the Yeti, I think, to be sort of a bad spirit, and which is not entirely different from if we were to, you know, kind of equate Wendigos with Sasquatch and Bigfoot, you know, the Native American interpretations of those sorts of creatures. So, you know. And they're all devils, yes. They're all devils. They're all folk devils. Chris, I know you've got a different list of folk devils over there than I do. Do you have anything really weird on the master list there? We've got to get to the real weird ones now.
Yeah, no, it's not like we haven't been talking about weird stuff at all.
we haven't gotten weird yet. You know? We're going to get weird.
No, I mean, the only thing I have differing from you is demonic possessions.
Yeah,
but that's more of a personal folk devil than a societal one.
It is, but nonetheless, you know, see, but here's the thing. The following the definition of a Fortean folk devil, maybe not so much. You know, I don't want to, you know, misconstrue the idea that, you know, we're talking about there having to be a physical representation in a creature or a monster or, you know, something like that. With demonic possession, it's a very clearly, you know, outlined phenomenon, and it's supernatural in nature. And yes, it seems to be, you know, one cultural, you know, or religious interpretation, not, again, you know, that's, you know, singular just in Christianity, but it's certainly very popular in Christianity.
We're interviewing a folk devil next Saturday, Colleen Thomas.
Colleen Thomas, there you go, a folk devil, you know. You know, some people would probably call me a folk devil, but I think that with demonic possession, and actually, you know, Chris, I think you're probably, you know, talk about that subject than me, but I will just say this. That, you know, demonic possession is something that in the modern era many would, and even many in positions of, you know, authority in the church and in clerical capacities would say that it's probably a psychological phenomenon that has been treated, at least in most cases over the years, you know, as something that, you know, that was the cause, or that rather was the result of a bad spirit, you know. And so even though you might not be able to peg it like with a Bigfoot or a Mothman or a singular evil entity, It's a clearly defined phenomenon. Wouldn't you agree, Chris?
Well, yeah, and like you were talking about with psychological issues, before the modern age and we had things like the DSM floating around, it would be understandable to attribute things like schizophrenia and associative personality disorder to being possessed by a devil, because one day you're fine, the next day you're freaking out and speaking in all these weird ways you wouldn't ordinarily speak, and people didn't automatically think, I bet he's schizophrenic. No, yeah. It was being possessed by an evil spirit. But today, to do that seems a little intellectually false.
Yeah.
However, it, you know, if you are in in such a fundamentalist way, or maybe not even being fundamentalist, but if you truly believe you're being possessed by a demon, then it's only a service being done to have an exorcist come out and expel the demon, but then the exorcist should be responsible and say, you should go ahead and seek some other help just in case, you know, if you have to say just in case the demon comes back, then by all means do that. But seek some help outside of being tied to a bed and have holy water thrown on
you. Yeah, in other words, the religious, you know, interpretation of that. Now, you know, that said, I think that, you know, in most, religious faiths today that actually practice exorcism, as I understand it, most of them do try and err on the side of caution and treat it as a psychological disorder. But again, you know, psychological disorders, mental illness and things like that, although various cultures, I talk about this in Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, my book, you know, even primitive cultures, you know, there's some of the Eskimo tribes, and I think also the Yanomano tribe describe, I think that they actually even have words for various forms of what we in the West would call mental illness. They make a distinction between that, okay, and a person who, you know, maybe claims to be possessed by a spirit or a shaman who claims to speak and interact with, you know, unseen, you know, entities and intelligences. You know, culturally, again, there seems to be, and there seems to have existed for a while, a distinction between mental illness and people who actually are either afflicted by or capable of interacting with, you know, otherworldly intelligences. But by the same token, you know, in the Middle Ages, however distinct, you know, various cultures may have, you know, may have made those two separate elements and ideas, we didn't have scientifically, you know, the knowledge base that is available to us today with regard to mental illness and the kinds of things that, you know, a person could actually suffer from. And relative to the interpretation of phenomena at that time, you know, in a society that was far more, you know, rooted in its fundamental theology, sure, you know, people, it's natural that they're going to interpret this as, you know, the presence of a malevolent spirit that's trying to hurt humankind. So, yeah, there's that folk devil element, even though, you know, you might actually pin that on a singular entity. And again, that brings us back to the root of all evil himself, Lucifer, Satan, the king of all folk devils.
Yes. Jeffrey Pritchett, we are many.
I think Jeffrey Pritchett is the devil, by the way.
I've been called that.
He wishes.
That's not what you said last night.
Oh, I know. You were a little devil. A little devil.
And I spanked your bare butt.
Bingo. Oh, no. That's funny.
All right. So
call me
Susan.
Let's
get into the Lucifer, the Prince of Darkness, the father of the Antichrist. What, I mean, as far as the Christian perception is that he exists, he fell from heaven. And I guess that's their whole folk devil, and he has legions of demons that do his bidding and all that whatnot. And I said whatnot. So, more stuff about Satan, Chris.
You want to tackle this one, theologian? I think he just said your name anyway.
Well, that'd be just fine. I mean, well, just generally, the devil is attributed to all evil in the world. So anything that happens is by definition the devil's fault. So, you know, when your crops fail, it's either because you are bad directly or you weren't good enough and you're being punished. And there's evidence of God and the devil working together to test or punish someone in the Old Testament, in Job, where the devil decides to mess with a, by all rights, good man for no reason, and God allows it. So the real question isn't, is the devil the original folk devil because he's bad, or is the devil the original folk devil because God lets it happen?
So is it actually that God is allowing bad things to happen to Job, who is actually persecuted by the devil, or is it God himself doing these bad things to Job, though?
It's the devil just allowing it to happen. The devil and God make a wager to see whether they can turn Job away from God.
Interesting, which, you know, I think is kind of open to interpretation in itself, really. I mean, of course.
Which begs the question, is God indirectly responsible?
Yes, indirectly responsible for the ills of mankind, because he's constantly playing, you know, a game of
not a dick.
Yeah, God's a dick for doing that, man. I mean, I'm not going to, like, worship him. I mean,
hey,
what's up with that?
He on the East Coast, it is technically Sunday morning, so be careful.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I'm in Philly. I'm in Philly. I can say whatever the fuck I want. So, you know, at 1 in the morning.
Yeah, safe harbor, man. Gosh. You guys.
So
great.
I'm curious, Chris, as an atheist, do you think aliens created us? Would they be gods in some level? Or do you just don't believe in the whole white fat dude with a beard throwing thunderbolts kind of thing and little fat chubby, which I don't believe in that either, but where does the concept of aliens being our creator possibly fit into the atheism spectrum?
Well, logically, it would be a little more easy for me to believe that because, I mean, if you have a technologically advanced race that has the capability of traveling, you know, light years to find a barren planet, if they feel like taking whatever happens to be there and doing genetic experiments like would be considered with the Nephilim, where angels have unholy offspring with humans, it could be really abductees being genetically experimented on and having weird half-breed children that turn out to be giants. So they scrap that. That's why you only hear about the Nephilim once or twice in the Bible instead of throughout. But as far as not believing in a old man with a beard and chubby angels, that's pretty much where I draw the line. I'm okay with aliens, because
you know, and they all their children with gigantism. Andre the Giant's running around.
I honestly, when it comes to God, I believe there's a supreme force, like the Great Spirit, all that is. That's like this pure energy, and I think mankind has it completely misunderstood, and they like put all these human things on it. They make it like a man. It's not. It's just this energy. And then I don't believe that God did this thing with some dude and, like, you know, made a deal about human races. Like, if you read Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh, that's a God that I could believe in. God says, hey, I never told anybody to murder anyone. They just did that for their own, you know, purposes to manipulate, you know, whatever. So
listen, that whole story, that creation story and the story with Jesus being born in the manger and the light, those stories were all passed down from other cultures. I mean, if you go back, you keep going back, you're going to find all these similarities to the same, it's the same story, like the flood story and all that. It's the same thing.
Yeah. No, I insist, you, sir.
Is Cthulhu a folk devil?
He certainly could
Cthulhu,
be.
Cthulhu, it's is the man, let me tell you.
We had to bring up H.P. Lovecraft and Cthulhu and all that stuff with Micah here. If we didn't, it wouldn't be right.
Yeah, it does seem there's a whole legion of people out there who know that Micah Hanks, you know, I'm a has-been, you know, wannabe 14 guy, but I'm a Lovecraft nut. So what's interesting about Lovecraft is that, you know, a lot of people have seen there's probably enough information actually that I've dug into over the years to constitute an entire book about things that Lovecraft touched on in his fiction that could be applied to the real world and to various interpretations of strange phenomena. You know, what I touched on in my book was the story From Beyond, in which there's a mad scientist named Crawford Tillinghast who actually creates a device, a machine that causes a resonance, okay, and this resonance, it's like this field, you know, that's emitted by this object causes those standing near it it causes their pineal gland to resonate with the actual machine, and hence they're able to actually see, you know, into another realm. You know, they're able to see creatures, quote unquote, from beyond. And what's interesting about that, of course, is something that, you know, my friend and colleague, Mr. Hayes here, as well as myself, we're certainly both interested in the research of Dr. Rick Strassman with regard to clinical DEA approved studies in the 1990s with the psychedelic substance dimethyltryptamine, DMT is, you know, the more common term. And it's very, 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 I mean, very high output, you know, very potent psychedelic. It's actually produced in the human body. Strassman wonders if indeed it might not be produced in the pineal gland. And, of course, I believe it was Descartes, you know him? Descartes. I always want to try and put the S in there. Descartes said that the pineal gland represents the seat of the human soul. So, you know, looking at, and actually the Tibetan Book of the Dead also discussed circumstances that seemed to, you know, have relation both physiologically and chemically to the way that the pineal gland, you know, behaves and forms in the womb, you know, as a, you know, a human fetus is developing. So it's interesting that, you know, throughout history there are cultural, you know, kind of perspectives and things that lend themselves to some significance being behind the pineal gland, okay, and its ability to literally alter our perception of this world in ways that might put us in touch with things from beyond. And here H.P. Lovecraft, you know, back in the day, was writing about that. I think that story was probably written in the 20s or 30s, you know, decades before, you know, had any kind of, you know, understanding of, you know, how dimethyltryptamine might, you know, be produced in the body and how it might affect the brain. And furthermore, as Strassman and some of these fellows have advocated, you know, how it could be used as a quote-unquote inner path to outer space.
So aren't the Lovecraft pantheon of gods and stuff, aren't they kind of like based on real supposed interstellar creatures like Tiamat and friggin' it seems like Cthulhu, maybe like Leviathan, Sumerian gods, Marduk, and you know that's Necronomicon, but they're kind of, I mean, they're kind of aligned with some certain deities in other cultures too, don't they?
They're aligned with what we would call folk devils from other cultures. Yes.
Yes.
Dagon and things like that. You know, I think that term Dagon.
That is a great movie, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, I have that.
Yeah, and that film is based on the story of the Shadow of Innsmouth. Was that the story?
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting story. Of course, I like all Lovecraft stuff. I mean, it's a little wordy by today's standards, but you wonder why I use all these big words. You know, you grew up reading H.P. Lovecraft, Black Seas of Infinity. He was the first author I ever saw use the expression, her eyes were slightly over-protuberant, you know, stuff like that. So,
Guillermo del Toro, the guy that did Hellboy and all that stuff, he's doing Into the Mouth of, At the Mountains
Into
of
the
Mouth or whatever.
Yeah. Cameron is producing it to make sure he has the financing and all the backing to get it made. It's going to be a temple R-rated horror, so it's going to be good.
Yeah, I mean, it's rare that you find a good H.P. Lovecraft movie. There's a lot of crappy ones out there, so hopefully this will be like a masterpiece.
Check out From Beyond, though. You know, it's got Jeffrey Combs, I think, was the actor.
I've
seen it like. I've seen it like 50 times, man. I'm
preaching to the choir here. Yeah, you guys know what I'm talking about. And it's funny because, I mean, as weird as that story is, you know, it's a classic film, and it's also, you know, it has some elements that could be based in at least some truth. And again, you know, when it comes to Lovecraft being able to predict strange things, you know, that are foreseen in nature, that you could almost, you know, write an entire book about that. So who knows, maybe Chris Hayes and I'll undertake that, or at very least maybe we'll dig into this folk devil idea and try and work out some sort of a pulp script, a volume of arcane lore. But, you know, before we get off the subject of Lovecraft, I have to say that Mr. Hayes here, in addition to everything else he does, he's also a film guy. So, you know, I just can't pronounce names tonight. Guillermo del Toro, right, the director, he's going to be doing it at the Mountains of Madness. Are you excited about this one, or is this just going to be crap?
I'm incredibly excited because if anyone can do it, it's him. If you've seen any of his movies, he's got all the puppet work. He's got all the practical effects that I personally prefer much better than CGI, and his storytelling prowess is just...
We're talking about a guy who actually has an education. In addition to anthropology and theology, you also studied special effects and makeup professionally too, did you not?
I didn't study it professionally, I kind of dumb-lucked into it.
Oh, okay, I see. I got you. But he is a good... He works with films and things like that also, so Mr. Hayes, you know, that sounds like a good endorsement there.
Yeah, Hellboy has some Lovecraftian kind of elements to it, from the comic and the movies, of course, so you can kind of see some elements of that. He's also Hellboy 3 is a future definite possibility. I read about him talking about in an interview, or Ron Perlman was talking about it. But yeah, that movie's going to be a must-see when it comes to Lovecraft and all that madness.
Fascinating films, yeah. That's going to be great. And if it's anything like the Hellboy films, or did he do Pan's Labyrinth also?
Yeah.
And that film actually has a homunculus in it, you know, which is another favorite subject of mine.
Help me!
That's an inside joke.
A mandrit root.
Yes, indeed. You know, that's a whole weird thing. But you know, maybe you could even call the homunculus a sort of a folk devil in a strange way, because you know the homunculus, the Jewish golem, the idea among the Hindus in the east of the tulpa that John Keel talked about, and then of course the 19th century theosophists and the idea of thought forms. You know, all these things are sort of representations of, you know, entities that are literally created by the human mind and intense focused concentration. It's not so much an intense focused concentration with the homunculus, you know, which is literally a little man that's made to do one's bidding, and you take the root of the mandrake and, you know, feed it blood, and there are different you know, prescriptions as to how to actually create the homunculus. But you know, the idea of creating a non-human entity for your own, you know, liking and enjoyment, you know, that idea also I think kind of might work into the folk devil, the 14 folk devilry there, so to speak.
I think this show we said devil the most I've ever said in my life on any show on my life. Hey, probably going to be Satan's going to appear tonight and put a pineapple up her butt. Like a little
You're going to get a visit from Papa Paula tonight, Jeffrey.
But you have to tell people that he'll come back.
Yes, he will. He'll come back all right.
The alien hand.
A perfect response.
All right, man. All right, guys. We got about 30 seconds, and you guys want to plug your stuff real quick?
Absolutely. Learn about Micah Hanks at www.micahhanks.com or visit my blog, The Graylien Report. That's GRAILIENReport.com. And, hey, Sunday nights from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern time, you got to listen to the Micah Hanks radio program on the Patriot Brigade Talk Radio Network. Chris?
Well, right now I'm currently not on the Internet or blogging or anything.
We'll change that.
Hopefully this will change things.
Yeah, there'll be some more of that to come. So, Chris Hayes, thank you for coming on with me tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, couldn't have done it.
Chris Hayes, friend of the show.
Yeah, he is. You'll be hearing more from him, for sure. And he is a folk devil, by Jove.
Make him come post to my forum.
You know, we could get him a gig with that. Would you like him to? Would you post on their forum? Can we give him a cool name? Folk Devil Chris Hayes?
Yeah, that's a good name.
Chris Folk Devil Hayes. Okay, well, we'll talk with you guys about that. We'll get that worked out for you.
All right, a pleasure, sir. Wonderful show. Darkly beautiful. Magnificently just horrific. I loved it.
We like being horrific. We're good at it.
Yes, horrific in a good way.
You guys have been great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Remember, MavisIncarnate.com. Come to the forum. Hang out. MavisIncarnate.com.
Abominably yours.
Yes, he has a section there.